Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, Crypto Frenzy. Now that more and more people are starting to trade crypto, the tax component becomes more important. We got to talk about it. Evan Thomas is the head of legal for Wealthsimple Crypto, and he's here to take us through what you need to know when it comes to reporting those capital gains or losses. They could be losses depending on when you bought and sold. Insuring your mortgage. It is important, yes, but life insurance and estate planning expert Michael Dutra doesn't think traditional mortgage insurance is the way to go. He's going to join us to talk about the downsides that he sees in that product and an alternative way to do it. Then, when it comes to achieving financial well-being, a lot of the onus is put on the individual. But Patrick Enns believes there is a shared responsibility with industry. He is the president of Capital One Canada, and he's going to be here to tell us why. And we've been highlighting plenty of the different budgeting apps on this show over the course of the last couple of years. One US-based app called Capital has a feature to help couples manage their money. A really interesting feature. Founders Catherine Salisbury and George Friedman will be here. They are a couple, and they also run Capital together. Plus, I'll speak to the author and founder of Broke Millennial, Erin Lowry, about her latest book. It is called Broke Millennial Talks Money, Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. Depending on how complicated your financial life is, filing taxes can be a real pain in the you know what. And now that crypto trading is becoming more and more common, some Canadians really need to understand the tax implications for their, hobby. For more on what you need to consider when filing your taxes as a crypto trader, I'm joined by Evan Thomas. He is the head of legal for Wealthsimple Crypto. Hello there.
Bruce, hello. How are you?
I mean, all the cool kids are trading crypto these days. I have mixed feelings about this. Given your role, were you required to open an account and trade multiple times a day?
No, not at all. In fact, well, I was a client of Wealthsimple Crypto before I worked for the company. But for my personal situation, I don't trade that frequently. And frankly, we actually don't see that very frequently. Most Canadians that we see investing in crypto tend to take more of a buy and hold approach. That's what we've seen.
So give me a sense for how knowledgeable people are on the tax implications here. It's certainly, we're doing this, having this conversation because people don't talk about it very much, but if you have hit the jackpot and scored big and sold your crypto, there's a capital gain there that you need to account for. How do people know this?
Well, no, you're absolutely right that there are tax implications to trading crypto. And last year, we actually did a survey on this to understand a bit more, because we could see that more and more Canadians were investing in crypto assets as part of their overall financial plan to understand their level of knowledge and comfort around the tax implications of trading. And that survey, first of all, it confirmed that absolutely, as we had observed, more and more Canadians were trading crypto, and particularly younger Canadians under 40, the Gen X millennials and Gen Z. But what we also found in this survey is that while many of these Canadians who are trading crypto anticipated needing to report and potentially pay taxes on their gains, they really didn't have a high level of knowledge about what that involved.
And it could be a capital gain. So you bought low, you sold high. It's not inside a registered account. So you have to, communicate that capital gain and pay tax on it. Is there also a circumstance in which it's income? They're reporting income?
Absolutely. It's going to depend on anyone, particularly the person's personal situation and how they approach trading of crypto assets. But just in the same way that someone who is, for example, day trading stocks might be considered to be engaging in a business and have to pay tax on income, that could be the case with trading crypto as well. And that's something that's acknowledged by the Canada Revenue Agency and its guidance. But by and large, Canadians who are buying, holding, and then eventually disposing of their crypto, they're more likely that they're trading for capital gains.
Where does the data come from? Because the institutions and the CRA are very good on the data around RRSP contributions. They are not good on the data for what you bought a stock for and what you sold it for. You have to do a bit of digging to do, you know, a capital gains calculation on a stock. I can imagine crypto getting accurate data might be even more difficult.
You know, that is the case. You know, right now, while Canadians are required to report their gains and losses and pay tax accordingly on crypto, there's no tax slips or something with that information. The obligation is on Canadians to assemble that information themselves. And actually, we identified this as a pain point for crypto investors. And so one of the new features we're offering in another Wealthsimple product, Wealthsimple Tax, which is our online tax filing product, is the ability to really pull in all of that data about when something was purchased, the price at which it was purchased from different crypto asset exchanges, and then calculate and report those gains and losses. We've added that, integrated that as a feature into the Wealthsimple Tax product to really do that work for Canadians by pulling that data from various sources to make it easier to do.
When you say pull it, is it like scraping, like a Quicken or a Mint would scrape my bank or brokerage accounts? Is it that sort of thing?
Generally, I mean, these crypto platforms generally have an API, the ability to not so much scraping, but to extract data from their platforms so that it can be analyzed for tax, and because the crypto platforms, including Wealthsimple Crypto, long known that users have this need to be able to pull information about their transactions and then be able to analyze it for various purposes, whether that be paying taxes or just understanding
bragging
their profits.
I'm so amazing, everybody. Of course, people only ever say that if they feel like they're a rock star. If they've had their heads served to them on a platter, no one will ever hear about it. I want to ask you about the link to CRA. How would the CRA find out if you didn't report?
That's not something I would certainly encourage people to. Would encourage people to
report. Do the right thing.
Do the right thing. Right now, at present, crypto platforms don't have to report to the CRA what trades their clients are engaging. That's not an obligation that crypto platforms have. The CRA has the ability, whether it's through auditing taxpayers or otherwise getting that information from platforms through court orders, to understand who's investing in what and what gains they may have had. But right now, we don't report that information to the CRA. Mm. We like to think that our clients, being responsible Canadians, are complying with their obligations to report their gains and losses and pay taxes, and we make it easy for them to do so.
What are the consequences if you don't file properly? I mean, let's take the case that the CRA does have perfect information, and if you don't, you're going to get caught, and there's going to be a consequence to that. What should crypto traders know about the consequences?
Well, I mean, just with any failure to accurately report taxes and pay taxes, or sorry, report gains or income and pay taxes, there's the possibility of penalties and interest. And obviously, there can be more severe penalties if it's actual tax evasion. But again, oversights or mistakes generally are addressed through penalties and interest. So it's important to do it right. And obviously, it's extremely important not to be actively evading this obligation.
To mention you will be boiled in the fiery pits of hell. I think that's the other thing. As Canadians, we pay our taxes around here. We say sorry, we're polite, and we listen to Celine Dion and Nickelback in equal measure, and we pay our taxes. I want to ask you about capital losses. And while the long-term curve for crypto has been very good, there have been real hills and valleys here. How does it work if what you're going to record is a loss?
Any other capital loss, that might be one that can be set off. Obviously, in that tax year, set off against any gains in that year, but either carried forward or brought back against other capital gains or losses that the taxpayer may have in other years.
Is there a difference for people who are trading within a business account? Is it more complicated?
Well, I think so. No, just our clients are individuals. So I can't claim to be an expert on businesses trading but crypto, but generally if someone is trading crypto for business purposes, then that's likely to be viewed as any gains are likely to be viewed as business income and have to be reported and taxed accordingly.
Interesting. Evan, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you about this.
Evan Thomas is the head of legal for Wealthsimple Crypto. And we were talking about how to go about filing your taxes as a crypto trader. You better do it, or I'm going to come and find you in the night and be really obnoxious and mean and loud.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Insurance is important. Insurance is really important when you're carrying a mortgage. But according to my next guest, protecting yourself with traditional mortgage insurance is not the way to go. Michael Dutra is the president of Michael Dutra Estate Planning and Insurance, and he joins us now to take us through some of the downsides of traditional mortgage insurance and what you should do instead. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Bruce.
So we got to define the terms here. A lot of people hear mortgage insurance, and they should be thinking mortgage default insurance, like what you need to get if you have a down payment on your home that's less than 20%, it's CMHC. What we're talking about is like mortgage life insurance. So tell us how that product works.
Right. And that's a good starting point. Some people already get the type of insurance confused from the beginning. But when we are talking about mortgage insurance, point number one I like to make is we should stop calling it mortgage insurance. It should be called creditor insurance on your mortgage.
Ah.
And the creditor is either the bank or the lending institution. So this is definitely not mortgage insurance for your family or anything like that. This is insurance for the lender, the bank or financial institution. So a small change in that title would make a big difference, I think, whether or not people actually end up buying it.
And how does the product work?
So creditor insurance on a mortgage, there's kind of like top five reasons I like to say as why you shouldn't be getting this type of insurance. So number one, the bank or lending institution is the beneficiary. So although I agree with getting insurance for a debt, I agree with, you know, doing that, I don't think many people want the bank to be the beneficiary. I think in their mind, they want their family to be the beneficiary. So if something happens to you, there's no money for the family, this is all in the favor of the lender of the money. So that's a huge problem I find as number one.
You said number two, because I've got the list in front of me, is that you're paying for decreasing coverage. And is it as simple as the fact that your mortgage balance should decline over time because you're paying it off every month?
Yes. So as you pay your mortgage off every single month, obviously it's going down a little bit incrementally. However, your premiums for this type of insurance do not decrease with the decreasing mortgage. So at the beginning, maybe your mortgage is $1 million and you're paying X amount, but after 5 or 10 years, your mortgage might be $600,000, yet you're still paying the same amount you were, you know, 10 or 20 years ago.
You don't love the fact that portability can be an issue. Tell us how that works here. I mean, we know what portability means if you're moving from house to house on your mortgage. How does it work with mortgage insurance?
So you don't actually own this insurance. This insurance is attached to the mortgage. So if you ever decide to switch your mortgage or leave your bank, you're not going to have to apply for new quote unquote mortgage insurance, and you're going to be older. It's going to cost you more. Mm-hmm. So every time you make that change, you're basically redoing this whole process.
Right. Post-claim underwriting is your fourth issue. Why do you bring that up?
This might be the most serious out of all five. Post-claim underwriting means if something happens to, you know, one of the spouses, mom or dad, and they pass away, the underwriting is done at that point, meaning there is still a risk that the insurance doesn't actually cover the mortgage. Perhaps if you forgot to say you had a heart issue on the application,
right,
or something like that, you still are at risk and you don't find out until it's too late.
Right. Whereas with traditional insurance, you do the blood work, you do the health check. And if you've got an underlying condition, they just won't give you the insurance, but you know that, and you go back and get a more expensive policy, or you just know that you're living without. Whereas in this case, you won't know that you didn't, air quotes, qualify until the time that you actually need it.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's expensive. What would be the framework for how, so say you're insuring a mortgage, I don't know, 500 grand. Ballpark monthly cost on that?
It's definitely, if these 4 points haven't sold you already, it's going to be more expensive. So it depends on your age and that sort of thing. But because the pool of people paying into this is a lot less than a traditional life insurance company, there's a lot less resources, so they have to charge more. So it's going to be more than the real way you should be doing it anyways.
Yeah. The real way, this is like the longest lead up in history, but you advocate for term, buying a term life insurance policy that has an amount that is sufficient to cover the mortgage. Is that correct?
Yes. Term life insurance is the original way you should be covering it. It is the only way you should be covering your mortgage.
So let's put that into context here. I don't know if you can do an apples to apples for me here, but let's say I bought a term life policy for 500 grand. And mentally, just to simplify, I'm only doing that so that my surviving spouse and kid will have that mortgage paid out. So that's for someone who's 40 years old is X dollars a month. If you were to compare apples to apples on mortgage insurance, what's the simple way to think about the difference?
Well, number one, with the term life insurance, your family is the beneficiary.
Yeah.
So that screams to go this way then versus the other way.
Yeah. And then they could clear the mortgage. They could invest that 500 grand in crypto. They could pay my gambling debts. They've got all the choice in the world. Whereas if it's mortgage insurance, they have no choice.
For sure. Gambling debts, number one, take care of that. Certainly invest it all into crypto. That's recommendation number two.
Of course.
But your family gets the money in a tax-free check. So if someone passes away, 500,000 gets paid tax-free to the family. And now they can decide what is the best use of this money. Because if you lose a parent, it doesn't always make sense to rush and pay down the mortgage. There's other financial needs that are immediate. So,
In today's interest rate environment, you actually wouldn't, I don't think you would pay down the mortgage.
Exactly.
But can you give me this apples to apples comparison, like a term life policy for 500 grand for an individual, say you're only insuring the main breadwinner, mm-hmm. They're 40 years old today. Is that like $100 a month or so?
No, it would be like, say for a female, it's under $40 a month.
For term?
For term 20, $500,000.
Gotcha. And what would it be for, what would mortgage insurance be for 500 grand to make the comparison?
It's going to be more. I'm going to say 20, 30% more, if not even more than that.
Got
like. It's completely worth doing the term. It will.
One of the hard parts of it, the mental math, is 20 to 30% more when the dollar ring is $40 doesn't seem like much. Even double doesn't seem like much. Like I'm just talking about the math as it's presented. You really have to think about the absolute dollars don't mean much. The percentage value might, but it's still a rounding error.
It could be. So if you're paying $40 and let's say the mortgage insurance is 50 or 60. I mean, even if it was the same price, the other reasons I already stated, it makes way more sense to do it. So even if it's, you know, $5-$10 a month cheaper, hey, you're saving $10 a month, 120 a year times 20 years, 2,400. So it does add up over that 20-year term.
The other thing that we haven't talked about, but it would seem there's a level of simplicity that a proper amount on term life gives you, because if you do mortgage insurance and you, first of all, and you have a kid, you're going to need term life anyway, because you're going to want to insure for the earning power of that breadwinner who's deceased.
Exactly. So you're going to most likely have term insurance anyways. You might as well include the mortgage value in the total amount of term insurance you have for your children.
Now, you're biased. It's what you sell. Who sells mortgage insurance? Is it direct to bank, or do traditional insurance providers also sell this product?
No, there are some insurance, I believe, providers that do offer it. Certainly any mortgage company, certainly banks, but it is still offered as a product by a lot of companies, to my surprise. So it's still around. And unfortunately, the name, whoever coined it, mortgage insurance, I think that sounds better to cover your mortgage than term life insurance does. So they win in that battle.
Gotta love the marketers, eh?
Gotta love the marketers.
Yeah. Michael, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, Bruce. I appreciate it.
Michael Dutra is president of Michael Dutra Estate Planning and Insurance. And our conversation was about the difference between mortgage life insurance versus mortgage default insurance, mortgage life insurance, and the downsides of that particular product in Michael's view versus another option, which would be a term life policy. So lots to think about on that front. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Patrick Enns, president of Capital One Canada. He'll be here to talk about why he says financial well-being is a shared responsibility, shared between the individual and industry. And later, broke millennial founder Aaron Lowry takes us through navigating some of the awkward money conversations you may need to have with your loved ones. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, it's very simple to do that. We have a newsletter, and the newsletter comes out once a month, and it includes links to all the stuff that we're doing on CBC Radio and Sirius XM and CityLine and BNN and blah, blah, blah. You go to moolala.ca, sign up, you'll get a newsletter once a month, and we won't do a thing with your email address other than send you that newsletter.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. We talk about financial literacy a lot. We talk about financial well-being a lot. But often, so often, it is a conversation that is focused on what one can do as an individual. And there is tons of stuff going on in industry to try and address these intractable problems. But our next guest would argue that this is a shared responsibility, that financial well-being is something that industry has a role in and the individual has a role in. He is Patrick Enns, president of Capital One Canada. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. When you say shared responsibility for financial well-being, what do you mean?
Yeah. And I guess based on your tee up, I'm optimistic that it's a tractable problem. Let me take a step back here first. I think a big part of what we're talking about in terms of shared responsibility is that customers or consumers have financial goals, and banks should have financial goals that are aligned, you know, with the customer themselves. And at Capital One, we're on a mission to change banking for good, and we're trying to help all Canadians be successful with credit. And we've seen from our own experience, with the right support and opportunity, tools and resources, that people can improve their credit over time, and that they can achieve their financial goals. So this notion that everyone has an opportunity and that financial goals can be achieved in partnership with a financial institution, I think there's a track record there that suggests this is possible.
What are some examples about what that can look like? And I ask because, let's call it a generation ago, before I had the role I had, you have the role that you have, back in the day, other leaders in this space would not have seen that shared responsibility, and they would have been out to drive volume in whatever way they could, because that's what pleased the P&L. What are some examples of where you believe we're taking some ground here?
Yeah, I mean, I think most financial institutions have started with financial literacy and education, which is a good thing. You know, transparency and education helps people make better decisions. But I think you might also agree it's not always enough. You know, the financial ecosystem is complex. So banks need to share in that responsibility of ensuring good outcomes. I think one of the places where we've seen the most movement in banking in Canada is in the investments and savings side. So if you just take that as an example, you know, with the advent of online trading platforms, robo-advisors, ETFs, the way that Canadians save and invest is dramatically different than a generation ago, or at least, I guess, Bruce, that's my understanding. And I think in many ways, that's all a good thing. But on the other hand, what you're seeing is that Canadians are now trying to figure out, well, do I need to invest in crypto or this latest meme stock? Or like, you know, should I be shifting away from the traditional investment strategies that, you know, that I'm used to? And I think a financial institution can look at that and say, hey, you know, all the information is publicly available. We'll make it super easy and convenient for you to do whatever you'd like to do, but the decision's yours. Or ultimately, what I think you'll see and are seeing is that some that take a more active role in helping guide, you know, their customers to an outcome that best suits, you know, the needs of that particular individual and their financial situation. So that's really what I'm talking about when I talk about shared responsibility. It's really about providing that equal access to services, tools, and resources.
What are some of the inherent conflicts between good for the individual and good for the bank? And I'll give you a super simple example. A bank offering to increase a credit limit on a card for an individual who is already having a hard time paying off their balance in full, or even making more than the minimum payment on a regular basis. That would be good for the bank because it's provided they're not going into default. They're a pretty profitable customer at the rates that banks charge. But it's another way to look at it, it is enabling poor behavior on the part of the individual. So what would you say are some of the conflicts? And then in a second, I'd like to talk about how we wrestle those to the ground. But what are some that seem obvious to you?
Yeah, I feel like you've highlighted a good one. Thematically, to me, it feels like often a time. It's a question of what's your time horizon, and are you optimizing for a short-term or a long-term horizon? Because I'd even say in the example you gave, if you look far enough out into the future, the banks and the consumers' interests are aligned. Ultimately, can someone pay back what they're going to be spending with? If you take a long enough perspective, the interests do become aligned. But where you take really short horizons, it can be challenging. If you're looking for other examples, I think interesting ones might be things that you see often in the housing market today, right? Where there's a balance there of how much of a mortgage should someone get to live in the home they want to have versus how much might they be able to afford over a 25-year horizon. That's a really long, you know, time horizon. It's not obvious how someone's financial situation is going to play out over that time horizon as well.
Yeah. I mean, I work with a lot of individuals and I see what the bank would say they can afford, but it's a pretty low sophistication to include the other goals that individual might have. Education for a kid, you know, health issues, an interest in one part of a couple to take time off after a kid. And when you factor those sorts of things in, the total affordability for a house is a whole lot lower.
Yeah, certainly. Definitely. I think your example makes perfect sense, Bruce.
What are some of the product and service gaps that you see as we talk about this future? Like if you and I were having a conversation about food, we might talk about food deserts in lower income neighborhoods. Like you literally cannot get a head of lettuce there. What is the financial equivalent in financial services, do you think?
I don't know if there is a perfect equivalent to lettuce, and I can't imagine living certainly in some of the territories that we have here in Canada where that is literally a challenge. That's a painful thought there, Bruce. Mostly what I think I've seen in the Canadian marketplace, and it comes back to what Capital One exists to do. When we say help all Canadians succeed with credit, we're really pointing out that there's a gap in the market where many of the financial institutions aren't playing in the full spectrum of the Canadian population. And they see some consumers and say, hey, I don't think that over time you're going to be a good credit risk for us as a bank. Well, ultimately, there's a person at the end of that who's trying to achieve their own hopes and dreams, has their own financial goals, is trying to feed the family that they have, you know, at home. And that's where, you know, Capital One has stepped in and I think done a nice job. I do think there's risks that if those needs are not met for consumers, you can sometimes see them take a different path, which can be more expensive. You know, the example there might be some of the payday loan services that have been in existence here for some time.
What is the most exciting thing you see when you look out on the digital pipeline. So digital innovation is everywhere, super exciting. There's, you know, buy now, pay later is one big innovation. I don't know how excited I am about it. It's a bit problematic, yeah. But there are other things that incorporate behavioral science, and that from your vantage point, as you look at financial inclusion and some populations that have a harder time here, what's the role of digital?
Yeah, I think when you look out into the future, there's two big things on the horizon that I'm excited about, open banking and real-time payment rails. And maybe just to pull those things together, when I say open banking, I'm talking about a shared set of standards and protocols for safely storing, securing, and transmitting a customer's data, and then ultimately empowering a consumer to decide who gets access to their data. And then I think when you combine that, you know, with real-time payment rails and the ability to move money instantly between financial institutions, I think that opens up a whole bunch of doors about what products and services you might see exist. And it really empowers consumers to say, listen, I can do business with anyone. Whoever's got the best products and services out there, I can do business with them. And there's going to be a system in place that's going to help me navigate the complexity that might come with that in like the world that we have today.
Say more about real-time payments.
Yeah, I mean, today it just takes time to get money between financial institutions. It often doesn't take time within a financial institution. It's like this kind of, you know, walled garden set up where consumers are incentivized to stay with one financial institution. But in a world where the payments infrastructure in Canada is modernized and you can start moving money instantaneously between financial institutions, I don't necessarily need to worry as much about managing how much time it's going to take me to get money from bank account A to bill B or whatever that might be, which is a huge source of complexity and frustration for Canadians today.
If there was one final thought, maybe it is a hope, maybe it is a call to action for individuals or for industry on this topic of financial inclusion, which we clearly have a shared value around, what would be your last word?
Think long-term, think about your customer, and think about, you know, an investment in that customer as a long-term investment. There's a lot that's going to happen over the course of someone's life. There's a lot of different needs they're going to have. Don't think about it as that one moment in time, and certainly don't think about that one financial service or product in isolation. As you pointed out so beautifully, Bruce, it's a much, much more complex situation for every individual.
Patrick, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Bruce.
Patrick Enns, President of Capital One Canada.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to Erin Lowry from Broke Millennial about her book, Broke Millennial Talks Money, Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. But first, managing your money goals in a relationship. I'll speak with Catherine Salisbury and George Friedman, founders of Capital, a budgeting app with a feature just for couples.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are so many budgeting apps out there. I think there are probably more budgeting apps available than brands of shampoo. I don't know if I could quantify that, but there are a lot. And we talk about a lot of them on this show. One app, though, that we haven't talked about is called Capital. It has a feature where you and your partner can keep track of your finances together, so you're working towards shared spending and saving goals. And we're going to talk about how it works for a lot of couples in the real world and see how an app could make that work in the digital world for them as well. I am joined by Capital founders Catherine Salisbury and George Friedman. They are a couple, and they are joining us in Järva, Sweden. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Catherine, let me start with you. You live in Sweden. Fantastic. Awesome. Tell us how Capital works.
Well, Capital is an app where you can do pretty much all of your planning. You can, we think of everything from a goal. So do I want to go skiing? Do I want to retire? Do I have a tuition payment coming up in September? And so, for example, George and I will make those goals together. We can both see them. Then we can decide how we're going to save for them. Every time our paycheck hits, we each put 1% towards retirement or something like that. And then capital will actually take that money and invest it for you, or we can put it into your spending account so that you can spend it on the things you want, and you can keep track of essentially your plan.
George, what was the insight that led you to this couple application? Because I said at the off the top, most of the apps are focused on individuals. You're a one human. It, you know, scrapes your one bank account. Mm-hmm. And yet a lot of people, practically, they have a spouse. Was there some blinding moment where you looked at Catherine and was like, we have to build this?
It's always been in the back of my mind since we started. So we launched Capital in 2015, and we passed 2 million users and saved well over $1 billion on the platform. We launched as a early test joint goals. So you can save towards, you know, your ski vacation or trip or furniture or refurb or whatever it is together. And then after about 2 years, you start to look at the course, look at the data of the joint savers, and they're way more successful, way more engaged. So we decided to take the entire platform to a joint mm-hmm. solution. So that was the insight.
Capital is spelled Q-A-P-I-T-A-L. Its focus is on U.S. banks, and we're, you know, Canadian, but I thought the idea was so interesting that even if it's hard for people to use, they should know about it. A part of the couple dynamic, certainly in my marriage, is the conversations around the money. How do you think about enabling those conversations so the utility of this, you call it the dream team functionality, isn't limited to just the numbers?
The way we have set it up is we can actually communicate about our goals or our transactions or whatever it is inside the app. And we did that because we personally find it very irritating. I find it irritating if at the end of the day, I'm brushing my teeth and George says, what was that big expense on Amazon? So this way he can tag it in the app, kind of like a Google Doc experience, and put a question mark, and I can respond and say, that was a gift for your mother or something.
Can George put on an emoji like a fiery yep. devil? Can you?
I do that all the time. Yeah.
Oh, you do. And Catherine,
and I love not having to interrupt teeth brushing.
right. Catherine, how does that go over when he puts on an emoji? Is that easy, or is that like, I'm going to come and in real life club you?
I don't love getting questioned on my spending. And we think that, so we were doing some studies, 80% of women do 80% of the spending. And when I say that, a lot of people chuckle and think, oh yeah, women are shopaholics or something. And our theory is that's not it. We do the procurement in the household, you know, as we take on different roles. Mm-hmm. I buy the diapers and the shampoo and things like that. So there are just tons of these spending moments. And I just don't love being checked in on that, on the specifics. And so mm-hmm. this is a way to go back and forth without any love lost.
George, you're a part of this mini focus group because you are in this circumstance. What are the limitations of the technology? I mean, we joke about the emojis and all that, but where does the technology end and the relationship dynamic begin?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we've come really far with our roadmap, but there's so much more work to do. And a key word for us is automation. We're really trying to build artificial intelligence to automate as much as humanly possible for you. So it's an autopilot for your money. Self-driving money is our vision. But we do a pretty good job splitting up your paycheck, getting them into long-term goals, short-term goals, spending accounts for discretionary spend and bills. Those four main buckets we're pretty good at, but there's way more that's happening throughout the month, decision-making wise, that we want to automate for you.
Catherine, how does the app guide you to make decisions that couples need to make? For example, what percentage of my income versus your income goes into the family pot? Some couples do it 50-50, even when there's income disparity. Some people have it be percentage-based. How does the app enable that sort of thing? Do they provide rules of thumb, or is it left up to the couple to figure it all out?
It's largely left up to the couple, but the way the tools we have in place is when you put the goals together, you know, when George and I sit down and say, here are the five things we want to be sure we can do this year, and here are the long-term goals, and here's how much money we need for it. Then when you start to, we have a product called Payday Divvy, so you can see our paycheck and we can say, okay, if we put this much in and this much in, you know, how much is left? Before you know it, you realize that you're going to have to give and take if you want to meet the goals together. So it's more like a good therapist who asks you some questions and you answer for yourself. Okay, I guess I'm going to have to cough up a bit more if we're going to get there.
Not every couple makes it. I don't know what the stats are in Sweden, but the stats in North America are not particularly encouraging. How do couples unwind from the dream team when their marriage no longer fits that phrase?
That's a great question. Technically, behind the scenes, everyone has their own bank accounts. These aren't joint accounts. So for example, if George and I are saving to take the family skiing, then the experience with capital is one goal, and we can see how much each of us has contributed and how much is in the pot. But behind the scenes, the amount I contributed is in my account and the amount George contributed is in his account.
Really interesting stuff. George, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us to talk about it today.
Thanks for having us.
Catherine Salisbury and George Friedman are the founders of Capital. They joined us from Järva, Sweden, an interruption into their fantastic ski vacation to talk about their dream team tool. Stay with us. Coming up next, Erin Lowry from Broke Millennial is here to share her advice on how to have conversations about finances with your loved ones. She's even got scripts, very specific scripts for some of the hardest to have conversations. I am also the money columnist for a television show called Cityline. And if you want to check out some of those segments, cityline.tv is the address there. Moolala is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We know that talking about money can be awkward. It can be really awkward. It can be really uncomfortable. But these are conversations that are kind of necessary to have. So how do you go about navigating these conversations with your partner, family members, your coworkers and friends? Erin Lowry is an author. She is founder of Broke Millennial, and she is here to talk about her latest book, Broke Millennial Talks Money, Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. She joins us from Manhattan, New York. Hello there.
Hello.
It is awkward. And I was just going through, I mean, just the table of contents of your book, you get into it on conversations that, I mean, some of your chapter titles are triggering. So you have a chapter called How to Ask Your Parents If You'll Need to Take Care of Them Financially. That's pretty on the nose. Why did you feel that it was important for us to, I'm going to use this word intentionally, confront our concerns about having these conversations?
You know, I think a lot about the fact that there's so much information about how to build a strong financial life and then how to start investing. And we talk budgeting and we talk saving and we talk hacks. But what happens is that you can build the strongest possible foundation for your financial life and begin accumulating and building wealth. And it's so easy to let other people spend your money unless you are able to navigate these conversations. It's much easier to just avoid.
So easier to let other people spend your money. What do you mean by that?
So just think about the wedding invitations, the retirement party invitations, the birthday dinners, every family Christmas, the trips that your friends want to take. It is so easy. And a lot of these things we want to do. Let me be clear. We want to participate, but we also have our own financial goals. And we have to make sure that we're balancing our own financial interests against what other people are asking of us. And oftentimes they're not doing it deliberately. They're not trying to spend your money. I come for wedding season really hard in the book. Also for context, I'm 32 years old. I'm like in the thick of it.
You're in it.
But at every age, there's a something, right? You know, there's always something where everybody's in this life stage and now we're being asked to fork over money to do XYZ things. And we have to learn how to balance and how to say no sometimes.
You use the word scripts in the title of your book. What are money scripts?
Oh, in this case, I mean like literal dialogue scripts about how to have these conversations. There are also... In the personal finance world, you sometimes also hear about money scripts in terms of how we emotionally relate to money, which is an entirely different thought process. And in this particular arena, I mean, no, I'm going to tell you how to say, mom and dad, am I your retirement plan? But not, of course, say it like that.
Yeah. Well, how would you say that one? How do you go about it?
Well, in that particular one, I like to think about a two-pronged approach, depending on what's going to work best on your parents.
Do you medicate them with booze before this conversation? Like is that part of the script?
Hey, it depends on how your parents relate to alcohol. For some parents, if you're going to get riled up, let's not go that route.
I
would advise, first and foremost, you ask either for their advice in order to get context clues for yourself. So if your parents are pretty good with their money and you've gone to them for financial questions before and that feels authentic to you, you can say something like, hey, I'm setting up a 401k for the first time and it's a little confusing. And I would love to know how you plan for your retirement. Maybe they'll say, I did XYZ. Maybe they'll say, I haven't. It gives you a lot of information.
Yes.
Otherwise, you could also just kind of go the easy route of saying, what do you want? And saying it more like, oh, my friend Jackie's parents just retired and they moved down to Florida, or enter other cliche thing here. And I was just really starting to think, what do you think you would like to do in retirement? And just getting kind of a broad picture of what they're thinking. Again, an answer might be, oh, I'll never retire. I'm never going to be able to retire. Or it might be, oh, here's this whole plan we've been thinking about. We just never clued you in.
Right. All of those things provide you with question 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
And it doesn't have to all be at one time. That's true of almost all of these conversations that I think is an incredibly critical piece to consider here, particularly if somebody's getting a little bit, I don't want to say aggressive, but in some cases it could be aggressive with you, or clearly getting uncomfortable with the conversation, back off, come back another time. And also, depending on the dynamic, you might not be the one that's the right person to ask the questions.
Right.
You might need to send somebody else in.
Yeah, I'm one of five kids and we play different roles in the family. And certain parents respond better to certain kids. Like it's, you know, you got to navigate the dynamics a little bit. I want to talk to you about friends because I think this is A, enormously influential in terms of how you spend, what's going on in your peer group, and B, under-discussed. We actually don't talk about this. How do you view salary numbers within a friend group as an example? Should you share those numbers?
You need to think about your why when it comes to sharing salary numbers with your friends. First of all, you probably got a little bit of a context about what certain friends make based on what their jobs are. If you're in a group of friends where somebody works in tech and somebody else is a public school teacher, we know they probably make very different salaries. So talking hard numbers might not actually be helpful in that particular situation because somebody might end up feeling bad or somebody might feel uncomfortable. The other important part is not so much just salary, because maybe you're a doctor and you're making $250,000, but you have $500,000 in student loan debt. So the salary number alone is not really giving you the full picture. I do feel that we should disclose debt to our friends, but it doesn't have to be the number. It's important for context. So if we're thinking we keep turning down these invites and we keep saying no, 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 it's more helpful if it's, hey, I would love to come on this trip with you, but I got to be honest, I'm trying to pay off, you know, $50,000 in student loans in the next 2 years. And that's really my priority right now. Instead, could we and offer an alternative that fits your budget?
It sounds like consistent with your chapter around boundaries. What other boundaries could one set in a friend context?
Well, in a friend context, when it comes to boundaries, one, it's important to talk about values, but it's very important that you're not sounding judgmental of your friend's values either. It is quite common that you value different things. So if your one friend wants to keep going to expensive restaurants because they're a big foodie and that's something that they really love to do, well, you might want to opt out of that particular endeavor, but don't say it as, I don't really value that, because it's rude and that might make them feel bad. But you should also be spending in alignment with what you value and setting boundaries around that.
What do you do in practice with the flood of wedding invitations that are swirling around your social circle? And aside from the groove and dance party you're really excited about, the bridesmaid's dress, the wedding shower, and the wedding gift might exceed what you can afford in a given year.
Especially if you're asked to multiple and to be in multiple in the same year. I recommend people start a savings fund for other people's weddings really early. I started one in my, I think I was 24, 25. It was called Other People's Weddings, and I put money in it every month. Wow. Highly recommend. It gives you a lot more flexibility, but you also big time have to set boundaries and explain your boundary. Hey, I want to be there for all the important things going on, and I would love to be a bridesmaid. However, I'm also in 2 other weddings this year and invited to 3 more. So I really can't do all of the engagement party, the bridal shower, the bachelorette party, and the wedding, all of which require travel. So which one other than the wedding is the most important to you for me to attend? Setting boundaries like that and doing it really early so that it's not, oh, now that you've decided on the destination of the bachelor party, I am now saying no.
Right.
Because they were probably planning on your financial contribution when they ran those numbers.
I just rewatched Bridesmaids, and they did not do these things in that movie. It would have been less funny if they had done those things, but such a classic. I want to sneak
it's
in one more
practical.
Question. Yeah, that's right. I want to sneak in one more question. Fighting fair about money with your romantic partner, what is your single most important thing to keep in mind as conversations get heated?
I'm going to cheat and say 2.
Okay, fine.
The first thing is to know your partner's emotional triggers when it comes to money and don't push them, because you should know very early on, you should have a conversation with each other about how you emotionally relate to money and what makes those buttons get pushed when you're going to get upset. The other part of it is to come back to the value-based spending that you have. So talking about what you value both as individuals, but then more importantly, as a couple. And if you don't have financial goals in alignment with your values as a couple, that's problem number one. That's what you really need to sit down and do. And then the financial decisions that you're making should align with the values that you have as a couple and what you're trying to achieve.
So much in here. Erin, thank you for joining us today to talk about your book.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Erin Lowry is the author of Broke Millennial Talks Money, Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. She joined us today from New York. That is our show. A shout out to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, very simple to do that. At moolala.ca, you will see a subscription, button or place to subscribe to our monthly newsletter. So super simple to do that. If you would like to send us an email with thoughts, questions, story ideas, money scripts of your own, our address is ask@moolala.ca. On social media, I'm @BruceCellery on Twitter, Bruce Cellery Moolala on Facebook. Thanks very much for joining us and have a great day.